We have an esteemed panel of speakers who are excited to share with you new ways to increase the use of fresh local goods in your school breakfast program. They will share best practices for sourcing local dairy, grains, proteins, fruits, and vegetables for school breakfast. They will also discuss strategies for maximizing the shelf life of these food products and how incorporating local foods can boost student satisfaction with the program. So without further ado, let me introduce our speakers. First, Erin Heisem, Program Analyst at the Office of Community Food Systems at USDA, will share about sourcing local fresh foods for school breakfast. Afterwards, Kevin Roberts, Director of the Center for Excellence for Food Safety Research and Child Nutrition Program, will discuss strategies for keeping fresh produce safe. And finally, Herb Pelletier, Principal at Putney Central School, and Steve Head, Sustainability at Putney School District in Vermont, will discuss their farm-to-school breakfast program. After we hear from our speakers, we will have time for Q&A. So let's get started. I'll turn it over to you, Erin.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So thank you, Etienne, for that. My name is Erin Heisem. I'm with the Office of Community Food Systems here at USDA, and I'm excited to talk a little bit about procurement today. You can go to the next slide. So we're going to go over what my office does here at USDA and discuss kind of high-level procurement regulations and requirements. Procurement is a very big and lengthy topic, and we could really spend months and weeks discussing this. But today we're just going to give you a kind of touch on some high-level things to kind of help you thinking about how you may start procuring local foods for the breakfast program. Next slide, please. So the farm-to-school programs, or as I like to say, farm-to-everything, are housed in USDA's Office of Community Food Systems, and my office helps child nutrition program operators incorporate local foods into the National School Lunch Program and all associated programs, so school breakfast, as we'll talk about, the summer program, and CACFP. The office also works with tribal communities to better incorporate traditional foods into the meal programs. Another way to look at this is farm to school, farm to summer, farm to CACFP, or again, farm to everything is community food systems. And the office works to accomplish its mission through three main areas. First is grant making, so you may have heard of the USDA Farm to School Grant, training and technical assistance, and research. And according to the 2015 Farm to School Census, 42% of districts surveyed report participating in farm to school activities. That's more than 5,000 districts and over 4,200 schools nationwide. And while you can see here that lunch still is the predominant meal where we're incorporating local, breakfast is number two, and we are actually encouraging operators to purchase local throughout all of the programs that they are operating. So what do we mean when we say local? Defining local is one of the first steps in procuring food, and each district has to create a definition that works for their particular needs and goals. So you can see in this image here that you can define local regionally, so say you might say the Midwest region, or you might do statewide. This is South Dakota, so you could say local is South Dakota grown, or you might even do a hyper-local definition, say in a county or within a certain mileage. It can vary by season. It can vary by product. There is no federal definition of local. However, if you use your goals and your farm-to-school goals and you utilize your partners, school nutrition staff, local growers, distributors, and others to help define local, you're going to make sure that the definition best meets your needs. We like to say local spans the tray. So oftentimes schools start with produce, so fruits and vegetables, but we want to make sure that you know it also includes dairy, eggs, grains, protein items. And the most comprehensive local buying programs incorporate local products in all of the major food categories. There's a few things you might want to do when you are thinking about integrating local foods into your breakfast program. A good first step is doing a menu audit. This can be as simple as looking at cases of food that come into your kitchens or having an in-depth conversation with your food distributors. A few things to think about is know what is already processed or grown in your area or region and see if you may already be sourcing from that local provider. Many times your breads, rolls, buns, milk, they may all be coming from a local bakery or a dairy co-op. So you just need to do an audit to see what you already are sourcing locally and then work with your distributor to increase. Harvest of the Months are another great program that you may be able to start featuring certain items on your breakfast menu. Or another easy way is to substitute ingredients. So for example, Garrett County Public Schools in Western Maryland, they replace their normal breakfast meats with local sausage during the school's or during the state's Farm to School Week. Some more advanced farm-to-school programs are actually developing their own recipes based on what is seasonally available in their area. So we have like boat-to-school programs like in Oregon and Alaska where they utilize local seafood into their school meals programs. Or special events like School Breakfast Week could be a great opportunity to highlight and promote local dairy or local fruits that you're serving in your breakfast program. We're going to start digging into some of the federal procurement principles and regulations. And I just want to remind everyone that these apply to the various nutrition, child nutrition programs, not just breakfast. There's four key concepts that I'm going to go through, and they guide the procurement process. And it's important to abide by these principles to ensure that taxpayer money is only used to procure the best products or services at the lowest possible price. And the first concept is American grown, or the Buy American provision. And this requires schools or anyone who may be purchasing on behalf of schools to purchase domestically grown and processed foods to the maximum extent practical. For processed products, this would be 51% of the ingredients that must be domestically grown. And there are two situations that may warrant a waiver permitting the purchase of foreign products. And the first is if that product is not produced or manufactured in the U.S. in sufficient quantities of a satisfactory quality. So bananas and pineapples are good examples of this. And the second situation may be if the competitive bid reveals that the cost of the U.S. product is significantly higher than that of the foreign product. The second procurement regulation we're talking about is knowing and being aware of your state and local procurement regulations. So what I'll talk about today is the federal procurement regulations. However, many state and local municipalities have their own procurement regulations. And so each school or district should be aware of what their state and local regulations are, because you do have to abide by the strictest regulation. The most important principle of sound procurement is competition. So the regulations use the term full and open competition, which essentially means that all potential suppliers are on a level playing field. Competition is essential in ensuring schools are able to purchase high-quality goods and services at the lowest possible price. And the benefits of competitive procurement include both price and quality. It's important that schools do everything possible to avoid restricting competition, because the goal is to have as many suppliers as possible respond to every solicitation. And regarding farm to school or farm to breakfast in particular, you cannot use local as a product specification, as it's seen as limiting competition. So while schools may apply a geographic preference, excluding all non-locally grown agricultural products is overly restrictive and it limits that competition. The last key concept we're going to discuss before moving on to procurement methods is vendors who are responsive and responsible. So when you are awarding a vendor, you are awarding to both a responsive and a responsible vendor. Responsive means that the vendor must submit a response to a solicitation that conforms to all of the terms and conditions of that solicitation. So for example, say you're a school district and you want to purchase apples, but the vendor replies with a bid that's for peaches. That's not responsive. Or if you have a requirement where a vendor delivers to 5 sites and the vendor responds saying they can only deliver to 2 sites, that's not responsive either. Responsible means that the vendor is capable of performing successfully under the terms and conditions of the contract. So what you've outlined in the contract, the vendor is able to do. So for example, a school may use reputation as a factor to determine whether or not a vendor is responsible. So they may call other schools that have used that vendor to verify reputation. Regardless of which procurement method you're going to use, awards always must be made to responsive and responsible bidders. So we're going to delve into procurement methods. And like I said, this can get a little heady, but there's a lot of resources at the end of the presentation that will guide you through any questions you may have. So one of the most important things to understand is the small procurement threshold. This is the limit, which determines whether or not procurement is conducted formally or informally. The current federal government small purchase threshold is $150,000. However, state and localities may have lower purchase thresholds, and many of them do. So Delaware, for example, is $20,000, where California adjusts their threshold annually. And schools must follow the most restrictive thresholds. So if your total purchase amount is under the threshold, you can do an informal or a micro purchase, whereas if it's above, you can do more formal. You can go to the next slide. This is a general. This slide shows the informal procurement process. And the first step is to draft specifications. Again, this process is used when the estimated purchase amount falls below that small purchase threshold. So specifications outline the school's requirements for products, its delivery, the providers, many, many more things. They clearly show what it is the school is looking to procure, and this is an excellent way where you can start targeting or showing a preference for local. So for example, specifications may be written to target products that are unique to a region, or you might have technical requirements that talk about origin labeling, a farm of origin on the products. The second step of procurement, and this is where the informal and the formal process differs, is that in the formal process, the procurement needs to be publicly posted. The solicitation must be publicly posted. Whereas in the informal process, you are allowed to go to vendors that of your choosing. So again, if you're targeting local for informal process in, if you can go back one slide, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yep. So in the second step here, if you're identifying at least three sources to procure informally, you can just approach three local vendors. After you get your vendors and you evaluate their responses, then you determine it, you award the contract, and you manage the contract. Then we're going to go to the formal procurement. The formal procurement process, again, this is what you do when you are over that small purchase threshold, and the first step is to develop a solicitation. And this would either be an invitation for a bid or a request for proposal, and there are some differences between the two. The invitation to bid is predominantly awarded on price, whereas the request for proposal allows other factors to be considered. Some of those other factors might include technical expertise, past experience, quality of the proposed staffing. But the process is very similar. So you develop a solicitation, and then you're going to publicly announce the solicitation, as well evaluate your bidder's responses, award, and manage the contract. And on this slide here, we're seeing the general sections of a solicitation. So they might be named something different depending on your solicitation. But for all intents and purposes, the sections are the same throughout most of the procurement processes. If you go to the next slide, you'll see highlighted in blue the sections of a solicitation that really target local. And the main point of this is to say that you can include your desire for local in almost any part of your solicitation. But going through this slide here, in the introduction section, this is where the school has a chance to frame the bidder's perspective. So in this section, districts often talk – can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
We're going to be on the slide for a minute. So on this section in the introduction, districts often provide an overview of their programs. They say their percentage of free and reduced eligible students. They say what meals they serve. But they can also talk about their goals and priorities, particularly as they relate to local purchasing or farm-to-school initiatives. So while a school cannot specify that it only wants local products, the introduction offers an opportunity to emphasize the importance of the program to people who may be bidding on this contract. And you can see here they do things like setting percent goals. The general descriptions of goods and services, as well as the technical requirements section, is where you're going to really kind of hone in on that local preference there. So you may start requesting that vendors provide an origin labeling, meaning that they require to label farm of origin or provide a monthly report, origin report, or that a vendor might be able to do farm visits or cafeteria visits. And this way you're kind of targeting that local preference there. Evaluation, again, this is going to be common in RFPs, and this is where you will evaluate how well that vendor met all the criteria in your solicitation. Next slide. This really wanted to go over procurement today, but it would be amiss if we didn't talk about food education, as Farm to School is not just about local food purchasing, but also about food systems education, and breakfast in the classroom is a perfect opportunity to do some of this food education. So there's resources like My Plate, My State, which identifies what foods and flavors and recipes are in your territory. And then for procurement and Farm to School resources, we have the Farm to School Census, which is available online. If you are uncertain what your school district is doing with regards to Farm to School, are they purchasing local for breakfast? Are they doing it for lunch? You can go to the Farm to School Census. You can see where they're sourcing locally if they have a garden. Next slide.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm just going to keep going. We also have regional leads that are farm-to-school experts in every region of the country. So they could be your go-to if you don't have a contact maybe in your state agency. You can go to the regional leads and work with them to how you can increase local procurement in breakfast. And then because I know I went very fast through some procurement regulations, we do have a plethora of fact sheets available on our website, as well as an entire webinar series about finding, buying, and serving local foods, and the Procuring Local Foods for Child Nutrition Programs handbook. This guide is exceptionally helpful and useful in doing all procurement, whether it be micro-purchasing, informal, or formal methods.
Great. Thank you so much, Erin. Now I will turn it over to Kevin Roberts to discuss strategies for keeping fresh produce safe.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for inviting me to join you today. Before I get started talking about some of those strategies, I did want to share a little bit about the center and spend a minute talking about our Center of Excellence here at Kansas State so that those on the webinar who may not be familiar with our center and the work that we do know a little bit about us. But the center was funded in 2011 through a cooperative agreement with the United States Department of Agriculture. Next slide, please. Our mission is to conduct food safety research that meets the needs of FNS nutrition assistance programs and disseminate those results to a variety of audiences. And we do this research. We're based out of Manhattan, Kansas, but we really do this research all across the country, and we generally try and hit on USDA's seven regions and include the entire country, not just the Midwest. But once we do that research, we really work closely with our partners at USDA and the Institute of Child Nutrition based out of the University of Mississippi. And we take that research, and we don't just do research relative to produce, but we do the entire spectrum of food safety. And we take that research and turn it over to the Institute, who in turn develops educational programming and resources for child nutrition professionals all across the United States. Next slide. Our center leadership team consists of myself as the director, and then Dr. Kevin Sauer and Carol Shanklin. We make up the leadership team for the Center of Excellence. And next slide. We also have a very qualified group of staff that work with us. Carrie Cole is our project coordinator, and Paula Paez is our research associate professor. And then we have Michelle Elkhorn and Tracy Watkins, who also work as graduate research assistants for the center. Next slide. So getting into talking a little bit about receiving fresh produce, when you are receiving it, regardless of if it is from a commercial broadline distributor like a Sysco or a local producer, please be sure to check the produce before the truck leaves the operation. Some things that you might want to look for is to verify, of course, the quantity, which we probably all do anyway, but to check the temperature of that produce when it comes in, and then to evaluate the quality and condition and compare that to the standards for a U.S. Grade 1, for example. Is that what they're delivering to you? And then when you are looking at that produce, make sure to cut it open for internal defects. I don't know about you all, but personally, when I buy produce at the supermarket and take it home, there's nothing more maddening than cutting into a pear, for example, that has gone bad. And you don't necessarily have that option to cut into it in the grocery store, but you do once that distributor brings it in to make sure that that produce is good before taking a receipt of it. And then also check the dates of fresh cut products and make sure that those fresh cut products are indeed arriving at a proper date. When you are requesting or looking at fresh fruit and vegetable deliveries, make sure that you don't accept them on Fridays if at all possible. In some places that may not be possible, but if you can receive them earlier in the week, it's always better. If you take receipt of those on a Friday, they're going to set Saturday and Sunday before you ever start using them the following Monday. Next slide, please. Washing fruits or vegetables before storing them really makes them more likely to spoil because dampness encourages bacteria growth. When foods are dry, they're less likely to allow that bacterial growth. And if you think back to your first food safety class or your last food safety class, you may remember the acronym FATTOM, which describes the six conditions that foodborne pathogens prefer to grow in, and those are food, acidity, time, temperature, oxygen, and moisture. Once moisture or water is added, fresh produce becomes a more desirable environment to allow bacteria to grow or reproduce. So the best practice is to wash that produce right before using it. Next slide, please. These particular items, bananas, onions, pumpkins, sweet potatoes, winter squash, garlic, potatoes, and tomatoes, and watermelon, all do not require refrigeration. That means a temperature of 55 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit is acceptable for storage of these items. Next slide. When storing or looking at some different products, for example, apples, cabbage, cauliflower, those all require refrigerated storage. And you'll notice the ones that I have an asterisk on, green beans, oranges, cucumbers, and peppers, you can actually store those at a temperature a little bit higher than refrigeration temperatures. You can store those at 45 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Next slide, please. Can one apple really spoil the bunch? As a matter of fact, yes. And the same could be said for bananas, lettuce, and a number of other fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables ideally should be stored separately. And I know many school employees want to keep fruits and vegetables in the same section or area, and I've been in many school nutrition operations over the years. And some supervisors and managers and directors are very well organized, and you can walk into their produce storage or their dry storage and tell this because they have the fruits and vegetables very well organized. And so much so that some of them actually look like a filing cabinet. And it's great to be organized, and that certainly does help with inventory. But here's the problem. Many fruits and vegetables produce ethylene gas. Ethylene is a natural plant hormone released in the form of a gas, and ethylene is thought of or can be thought of as an aging hormone in plants. And it really triggers cells to degrade, fruit to turn softer or sweeter, leaves to droop, and seeds or buds to sprout. And ethylene may also be used when you want to accelerate ripening. And this is the principle behind placing an unripe fruit, for example, inside of a paper bag or another closed container, which concentrates that ethylene. Adding other high ethylene fruits, such as a ripe banana or an apple, may also speed up the process. This is also the same gas that commercial growers will use to ripen tomatoes, bananas, pears, and a few other fruits after they've been harvested. And while some fruits and vegetables are high ethylene producers, others are more sensitive to it, while other fruits, such as cherries and blueberries, do not produce much ethylene at all, and it doesn't influence their ripening. Ethylene is one of the reasons you shouldn't store onions and potatoes together, for example. And fruits release ethylene, which speeds up the ripening process of many vegetables. And the effects of elevated ethylene are cumulative. And some of the effects of high levels of ethylene would include decay, russet spotting, yellowing, odor, or wilting, and it also causes citrus to break down at the rind and loss of crunch in apples. And if you don't believe it and want to conduct a little science experiment at home, if you're like me, I always avoid buying a bunch of bananas because they all ripen so quickly. But if you break the bunch up and wrap each stem in plastic wrap, it really does slow down the ripening process. And that may not be plausible in most food service operations given the quantity of food that we're serving, but it will go to show you how important that ethylene gas is to ripeness and ripening of products. And if a banana, for example, reaches the ripeness you like but you're not ready to eat it, put it in the refrigerator, and cold will keep that from ripening any further. Next slide, please. The next thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was Produce Safety University. And Produce Safety University is an initiative through USDA, and some of you on the call may have had the benefit of attending Produce Safety, but this is essentially a week-long class that looks at produce safety. And it brings school food service staff from across the country in to identify and manage food safety risk associated with fresh produce. And that includes a combination of training and laboratory instruction, so it's not just sitting in the classroom all day long. And I had the benefit of going to this several years ago. And during those, we'll do field trips, and they visited fresh-cut processing facilities and produce distributors, terminal markets, and farms. And it's a very interesting approach to really get in and dig into what produce is and produce safety and the different levels of produce that you can deal with. Next slide, please. And it really does cover the whole spectrum when we talk about fresh produce in the supply chain. It talks about the growing, the harvesting, storage, and preparation. And you have sessions that deal with understanding good agricultural practices and what good handling practices are. And while you won't become an expert in either one of these, it will certainly provide you very useful tools that you can work with or use when you're working with those local growers and producers. You talk about writing specifications for fresh and fresh-cut produce, and you assess produce upon receiving, and you learn what to look for when that apple, for example, comes in the door and you've ordered a certain quantity or quality of that particular produce. And then you talk a little bit more and go in depth about storing fresh produce properly and handling that fresh produce during the food preparation and service aspects. Next slide, please. If you'd like to attend Produce Safety, please contact your state agency. While I can't remember for sure, I think the nominations for the 2017 courses are actually closed, but please reach out to your states. Many of those state agencies maintain an alternative list, and you can get on that list and connect with, or get on the list, connect with your state agencies, and they can tell you whether or not all slots have been filled. If you'd like to connect with PSU grads in your state, also contact your state agency for information. You can ask them about their experience, what they learned at the class. Many of the people that I've interacted with that have gone through Produce Safety have raved about it, so it's an excellent week-long class and very beneficial for those that go. Another thing that you could do if you follow hashtag ProduceSafetyU on Twitter, it is a great place to check for new resources. I have a few tweets posted on the slide there, but with it you can find comments from previous attendees, what they were doing during those classes, and they also post important announcements such as the call for nominations and when new resources will be available. For example, USDA is currently working on a Produce Safety Hack video series that will be, of course, free of charge, and when it is available, it will be promoted at the hashtag ProduceSafetyU. Next slide, please. And between USDA Office of Food Safety, the Institute of Child Nutrition, and the Center of Excellence, we have many, many free resources available to you. I have URLs on the screen that you can go to find a lot of these. USDA, for example, at their link has fact sheets. They have produce safety information sheets. They have videos, webinars, information on PSU, and they also have a take-home training. It's a train-the-trainer resources that are available for produce safety grads at that link. So there's a wealth of information available there. Of course, many of you may know of the Institute of Child Nutrition, which formerly was the National Food Service Management Institute. They have many different things on produce safety, from fact sheets to videos to talking points, and they have some very good information about working with local growers and handling school gardens properly. Of course, if you're not familiar with the Institute, they not only have produce safety, but they really have resources available, any resource that you would want to help school nutrition professionals in all aspects of the operation. And then the Center of Excellence, our website is there as well. We do a lot of research, so therefore we have a lot of research manuscripts on produce, produce washes, different ways of handling produce in the operation. We have some research posters, and if something is not there that you're specifically looking for and would like the answer, we try and be timely in our response, but you can reach out to us and ask us a question, and if we don't know the answer, we have several food safety scientists across campus that we can reach out to. And of course, best of all of these resources are free of charge to anyone who access them. So the price is right on those. Next slide, please. That concludes my part of the presentation. This is just our standard acknowledgments, but I will be happy to answer any questions as well once the webinar speakers have concluded.
Great. Thank you so much. That was so helpful and very informative. Now, I'd like to introduce Irv and Steve, who will talk about the farm-to-school breakfast program in their school district, Putney School District in Vermont.
Great. Thanks for having us. This is Irv Pelletier, and I'm here with Steve Head, our sustainability coordinator and the co-director of our food service program. One of the hallmarks of our school is that, well, first of all, we are a very small school. We have a pre-K through 8 program. We have about 170 kids. And it vacillates somewhat, but we're generally between 40 and 50% of the kids on free and reduced meals. We have 20 faculty and about 15 support staff. Next slide. So the genesis of our Breakfast After the Bell program really came out of our Farm to School project, which started about 3 years ago or so. And we had a number of folks get together, like-minded individuals, try to do goal setting around food, nutrition, and PE programs. And we were pretty honest about things, and we decided and found that, you know, we needed to really make some improvements in our small rural school. So with support, we started Farm to School Project, and as an ancillary piece of that, in terms of our overall approach to wellness at the school, we expanded our PE position from 0.8 to 1.0 FTE. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Steve.
No, that sounds about right. That's fine.
Okay, great. Next slide. So we had, as I said, a number of like-minded individuals. And when I say that, what I mean is that we pulled from all of the demographics within the school. We had a couple of parents involved. Our school board chair was very active, Alice Laughlin, very active in helping promote our farm-to-school project from its inception. We'd had a school garden program, which was sort of in stasis, frankly, when I first got here about 7 years ago. And it's since become a robust entity on campus, and it's unlike most school gardens that most people are used to, and we produce crops that we use in the kitchen for food. Last year, I think we harvested about 200 pounds of potatoes, for example. So we wanted to educate the kids around the food stream, where their food comes from, how it's grown, transported, etc. A big step for us was to move away from the commercial food service providers and take our food service in-house, everything from procurement to prep. And we made a very concerted effort to purchase local fresh food products whenever possible. And for us, early on, there was a comment about what local means. And for us, local really means as close to the school as possible. Maybe 30 to 50 miles away from school, as you know. I don't know, what do you think, Steve, about that?
Yeah, pretty much. There is a somewhat smaller percentage, though, that is ultra-local, meaning it comes right from our town.
Right. Yeah. And we're lucky enough in Vermont to have a number of farms around our school, close by, a couple of orchards, and local produce producers. In fact, one of our teachers is a family farmer. And so we've been able to purchase some stuff from her. And then we wanted to expand the existing school garden. And finally, it became clear to us that providing breakfast after the bell would be critically important and added to our already burgeoning lunch program. And then added also a light supper. Light supper really for us means that we'd have things like roll-up sandwiches and snacks, fruit, and so forth, available to the kids who are after school, either for tutoring, playing sports, any of the extended day offerings that we have here at Putney Central.
Right. That's the AMP program, the CFP.
Right. That's right.
Meal program.
That's right. So the after school. That little graphic on the side We have an annual dinner here at school right at the start of the school year, and each year we designate a recipient for any of the profits that come from that event. Our local co-op provides food and personnel to cook the food. It's really a fabulous outdoor gathering. We have music sometimes. Last year we had puppets and so forth. We had about 450 or 500 people attend that, and we were able to put some funding into the farm-to-school project. Next slide. So the how. So those of you out there wondering how to pull something like this off in your school, it really is critical, obviously, that your school board support your efforts. And I know in metropolitan areas with a much larger sort of demographic and different almost constitutional methodology, I guess I'd say, in terms of how school boards interact with schools, it can be more challenging. But we did garner our support from our school board with no problem whatsoever. As I mentioned earlier, we put together a farm-to-school committee, and then we enlisted support from and partnered with local and state organizations. One of the really great organizations that's a local group here for us is a group called Food Connects, and they've made terrific strides. It's a small nonprofit. I think they've got about maybe working for them, and they've made big, big strides in pulling together local producers and connecting them with schools. And it's been very, very good. The Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, I can't say enough about people like Ali Zaparo who really spend the bulk of their time working with schools and trying to make those connections that are so vital to having a good food service program for the kids. And then in Vermont, we also have the School Nutrition Association. Next slide. So, the commitments that came out of the Farm to School Committee and project really had to do with developing a sustainable vision. In other words, we know that, you know, people come and go, principals come and go, teachers come and go, school kitchen personnel come and go, although we've been very lucky there. So the decision was made to hire a sustainability coordinator, that's Steve. And he also serves as the co-director of food services. We wanted to partner with local vendors, we've already mentioned that, for veggie, dairy, and meats, and add sufficient personnel to support in-house food service. And that included having reasonable compensation and benefits. I don't know if you want to add something to that, Steve.
I think one of the things, though, that's important and where farm to school can be very helpful is we did receive a grant award last year for an implementation grant. And with that, we put together what we called a farmer forum evening, where we invited within a radius of roughly 10 miles as many local farmers as we could get, and just explained to them what we were doing and told them our constraints, especially our monetary constraints. But that we really wanted to partner with as many of them as possible. And I think often the problem is just they're not understanding where we are at and vice versa. So once they, I think, saw how difficult it was for us to get local food in and, you know, the small price we could afford often, some of them, they were all very supportive. Some of them said, you know, we're really supportive, but we're sorry we can't afford to do that. Others said, yeah, we'll do that every once in a while. And basically, it's part of the whole farm to school program. It just connects us, you know, connects everybody together. So there really is a buy-in. And that's what ultimately helped us start procuring a lot more, you know, ultra-local food.
Yeah, and one of the distinct advantages as well, I might add to Steve's comment, is that when you work with people on an ultra-local basis, they will partner with you and let you know when they have excess vegetables, excess produce of a particular type. One of the distinct advantages of having an in-house food service program is that we can adjust things on the fly. Sometimes we even adjust the menu from day to day. It's not the most popular thing with parents and sometimes with kids, but we are able to do it and to get produce in at a very reasonable cost in some cases, and it really helps with the bottom line because, you know, this program is designed to be self-sustaining, and which is always nice when you're talking with your school board types and, frankly, with your taxpayers who support your budget each year. And that can be a challenge. And we've been, so far, we're in year two of having taken it in-house, and things are going really quite well. Next slide, please. So, the Breakfast After the Bell program, that came about as a result of us looking at our breakfast program a couple of years ago. Now, breakfast in most schools is served before the bell, and there's lots of good reasons why that should happen. What happened in our school was that we had a number of kids, about 12 to 15 kids a day, who would have breakfast in the lunchroom, and almost without exception, they were the free and reduced lunch kids. So there was a level of stigma, I thought, attached to that for those kids. Also, there was the added pressure that all of their friends were outside having that before-school recess that we have each day here at Putney Central and wanting to be outside, naturally. So we did a pilot program 2 years ago, at the end of the school year, with the second grade. And we provided breakfast in the classroom for them after the bell. And what we found in that setting was there had originally in second grade been two or three kids doing it. The whole class of 16 or 17 at that time partook. So we knew that we were onto something valuable. So what we do, if you look at the graphic up on the screen, we have a list each day from the teachers about what the kids want. As far as whether they're going to participate in breakfast after the bell on a given day or not. You see the carts in the upper right there. We have about a dozen of those, one for each of the classrooms, including preschool. Steve works his tail off first thing in the morning and gets all the food for each of those carts onto the cart, and then you see the bottom picture. He's actually bringing one back to the lunchroom there, but he delivers. And if other people are available to help out, we bring them right to the classroom. Kids come in. Our school day starts here at 8:15. Kids come in. Depending upon teacher's preference, they can either dig right into the food or sometimes they'll wait until after their morning meeting, which usually is anywhere between 15 and 20 minutes to get the kids breakfast. Want to
add anything? Well, I guess one of the important things is, having been a teacher myself, I know that you don't want one more thing on your plate in the morning. And so we really try to cover all the bases, to really be working toward the teacher's schedule rather than to ours. And then so that way sometimes we'll hold up a meal and keep it cold or warm, depending upon the meal. In the kitchen until even 45 minutes later if they had some special in the morning and they wanted their breakfast a little bit later. But it is great to see the kids being able to sit down in the morning, unrushed, enjoy their meal while they're doing some warm-up activity or something like that. It really seems to kind of calm everyone down.
Yeah, and it's a little challenging to see in the images that are up on the screen, but we have a milk machine. It's down in the second image on the right, way down the back there. Steve's filling up the containers. We have saved countless thousands of milk containers. The milk is purchased from a local dairy here in Vermont, and it is fresh and comes in the, what is it, 2.5 gallon those containers?
5 gallon
bags.
5 gallon
bags. And so we replenish those on an as-needed basis. The kids can help themselves to the milk, and we deliver the milk skim and 1% along with the cups that they serve themselves. So there's an awful lot of social benefits to this as well, because the kids are learning some social skills that they might not otherwise have an opportunity to learn. Next slide. And as we mentioned, we have a commitment to local. One of the people who works in our kitchen actually has a family farm and orchard. It's not the Scott Farm, as you see on the right, but it's Harlow Farm, and they are large maple syrup producers. They give us an unbeatable price on the maple syrup, and we try to purchase as much as we can from them. And then we've got Scott Farm Orchard, which is right down the road in the next town from us in Dummerston. They have over, I don't know, what is it, like 100 different varieties of apples,
heirloom.
Many of them heirloom apples, and it's sort of their thing. They've been on site there since, I think, the mid-1800s, if I'm not mistaken. It's amazing,
the
longevity of that particular operation.
Yeah, and as I was going to say, as far as procurement issues, we do buy our syrup from other farmers, too, many of whom, I think they see it as kind of a goodwill gesture to sell to the school because some of their kids go here. And so and we're way underneath the threshold anyway. But also with apples, there's enough apple growers around here where we have spoken with them all, we kind of shift our buying. And some of it, as far as our buying, is seasonal. Some of them, for example, in the fall, have a lot of apples, but they don't have great storage, and so we buy as many as we can from those farmers in the fall when they're available. Another farm has great storage with, low oxygen plus nitrogen, and so they can hang on to their apples well into the spring, and so we can be getting apples from them, even in March and April. So we really kind of shift our purchasing around, but again, all of them are really cooperative with what we're trying to do, and so offer us a price that we can afford.
Yeah. Next slide, please. Yeah, so ultimately, right, this is all about our commitment to our children and their educations and their health and well-being. Anyone who's worked in a school for any length of time understands how critical nutrition is to kids being available to learn. And the Breakfast After the Bell program here has been hugely successful, I think, because, in part, the kids understand, we do the educational component as well, the kids understand how important good nutrition is to them. We serve wholesome, nutritious foods on a daily basis. We have fresh fruit and vegetables in the afternoon. We have, the light supper after school. We have excellent lunches, includes a full salad bar every day, a hot entree from often made from scratch. So the kids, they're being spoiled, frankly. I don't know if they'll get the same treatment once they get to high school after eighth grade. Some places do and some don't, but we're working super hard to try to provide these kids and by extension their families with the best that we possibly can. And I'm really proud to be part of this process. I think that at the end of the day, it's about a number of adults coming together, recognizing a need, having a shared value system about the importance of good nutrition, health, and exercise, general school wellness, climate, et cetera, and saying, hey, here's an opportunity. We can do this. And getting on board and putting in the time, and it's hard work sometimes, but we get it done. And as a result, I think the kids are far better off for it.
Okay. Yeah. Just simply... well, maybe not so simply, that this is kind of a long-term process as far as introducing some of these new foods. And it's kind of interesting to look at, we've been doing this for 3 years now, roughly, looking at the kindergarten, first and second grade. A lot of the salad bar items and kale and tofu and things that you normally wouldn't see in a cafeteria, to them it's normal now. And so... whereas the older kids who maybe began with, tater tots and all that stuff, they're kind of wondering what's going on. But within the next 8 years, all of the kids who would be eighth graders will have lived with this. And so it will be a part of the school culture. And I think we'll be finding that we can introduce more and more variety.
Right. And one thing I did forget to mention is that we do a monthly test of whatever seasonal vegetable is available to us. And some of the middle-aged kids, the kids who are in fourth and fifth grade, typically will take them around to all of the grades and keep some data on the responses to the kids so that we know how to tailor our menus going forward. And it's been very, very successful. And as Steve mentioned, the younger kids are really where we're putting a lot of people power because we know that as much as we would like to try to win over your dyed-in-the-wool eighth grader in terms of their eating habits, it's a little bit more of a challenge there. We'll stick with it with those kids, but we're really putting a lot of attention on the younger grades so that we can groom them. And it's the same thing with the gardening program, so that the kids can participate, get enthused about getting their hands dirty, and at the end of the day, eating their Brussels sprouts and their potatoes and so forth right out of their very own kitchen. It's pretty exciting stuff.
Great. Well, it sounds like you guys are doing great work. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm now going to take the call off of lecture mode so we can have some Q&A.
Okay.
The conference is no longer in lecture mode.
Hi, everyone. If you have a question, you can unmute your line and press star 6. Any questions?
While we're waiting for questions, this is Kevin Roberts. If you don't mind me stepping in, I was going to say that I received an email after I presented from USDA that said that the deadline for produce safety nominations has been extended till December 15th. So if anyone's interested in attending a 2017 session of Produce Safety University, please contact your state agency and let them know and you can get on the list.
Oh, great. Thank you. Breaking news on the Breakfast Matters webinar.
And okay. They may already be full at your state level, but it's worth a try to check with them at least. So.
Definitely. Thank you so much for sharing. Well, if no one has any questions, I have one that came through email. This is for Steve and Irv. Did you get any pushback from implementing this program in your community? And how? And any tips for talking to those stakeholders?
Well, I mean, to my mind, there was absolutely zero pushback. I mean, given recent developments in the world and in the country politically, it's probably pretty clear that Vermont considers itself a pretty progressive part of the world. And anything that you can do to support kids, their learning and nutrition is generally very well received. And I should say that a lot of this groundwork has been laid by, as I mentioned, Ali Zaparo and people like that from the Department of Agriculture and Markets here in Vermont, which very, very much is behind the farm-to-school movement. And it's been terrific. No pushback.
I will add, there was one minor thing, and which was kind of interesting, the outcome of it, was that when we switched to the bulk milk dispenser, we made our decision to serve nothing but white milk. We no chocolate milk, no flavor. And there were a number of people that said, hey, that's a bad idea. That's how you get kids to drink milk. They're not going to drink the milk. But it turned out to be the opposite effect. I think the milk coming in those bags is usually the same day milking or maybe the day before. It tastes much better. It's much colder. It doesn't have that cardboardy taste. The kids really like it, and so we've actually been selling more milk since we stopped. We started with a bulk milk dispenser, stopped serving chocolate milk. So that's the only thing I can really think of.
Yeah, I mean, I would only advise that if there's a sense of possible pushback, I mean, you can't anticipate every corner where something might have a concern, but I would say that from the very beginning, one of the reasons why we were successful is that we marshaled, as I said, like-minded people who shared the same sort of values around food and nutrition and wellness, all in the same room. And we said, what do you think? What should we do? And out of this, we looked outside of the building, outside of the district, out to the state level for support and happily found it. And it was, it's been very, very refreshing as a principal to be in a place. I'm in my seventh year here now at Putney Central. And it's been refreshing to be in a place where that's possible.
Great. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tanuja. I'm actually a dietetic intern. I'm doing my food service rotation right now, and I'm in a food service kitchen in the Bronx and just, learning production orders. And I was just wondering, based on the program at Putney, how do you manage multiple vendors in terms of delivery? Because I'm just working on getting like a U.S. Foods order, for example. And
right. That's a great question.
And that's already like much to do, but just how do you go about that?
I'll let Steve speak to that because he's really the guy in the trenches with that stuff.
Yeah, that's a very good question. That is the tough part of it. I guess at this point, with some of the ultra local stuff, I will actually pick some of that stuff up myself because it's usually on my way somewhere. But we also have, as Herb mentioned earlier, called Food Connect and the Wyndham Farm Network. And that's actually an organization that's actually expanding in other states where an entity will kind of do local procurement from local farms, deliver to schools and hospitals and things like that. It's something you might want to look up to see if something's available in southern New York there. Again, that was the Wyndham Farm and Food Network. I haven't found a great solution to working with multiple vendors yet, and I'm still working on
it. Yeah, it just seems like you're taking on the task of, you know, introducing more produce and local produce, but then also you have to consider what the logistics are behind that.
It's very difficult, and as you know, with the large vendors, local isn't necessarily on their mind. And so the only way to do that is to find alternate means. We are fortunate to have the Wyndham Farm and Food Network to do some of this for us. And they are expanding, and perhaps they're moving down towards your area.
Yeah, so one of the hallmarks of the farm to school movement on organizations connects have started to sprout up. Bad pun, but they are essentially, I wouldn't say they're displacing the major middlemen at this point, but their role as nonprofit is to help broker these connections between other nonprofit schools, hospitals, et cetera, that need a regular rotation of fresh produce, for example, but oftentimes lack the personnel to go out. We don't have a buyer, you know, so our school system is not that big. So places that have buyers, they can connect with these sorts of people. I would urge you to just check it out. It's on the web, Food Connects, and the person to get in touch with, if you're curious, is Richard Burkfield, and he is he is one of my parents, actually, here at school. He's got a couple of kids here. They're terrific.
All right. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Hi, this is Erin from USDA, too. And we have seen larger districts across the nation have success working with, like, say, distributors in targeting local and having the onus be on the distributor to pick up from the small or medium-sized local farmer and then kind of aggregate the products and deliver it to the school system. So there are some resources if you go to the USDA Farm and School website, especially that procurement guide and some of the webinar series, which may help you with that. Or you can shoot me an email and connect you with some of the larger districts that are purchasing local through a distributor.
Sure, thank you.
Hi, I just have a quick question, please.
Yeah.
When the school switched to only serving white milk, which type was it? Whole, 1%, skim, or other options?
Well, basically for a reimbursable meal, we can only serve 1% or skim. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to have those two. However, I will put a push in. for being able to serve even up to whole milk, and this goes to the federal government, because I know a lot of it had to do with obesity issues, but I don't think you necessarily have those issues with kids this young, and kids really, really much prefer whole milk. So that's my little plug.
Okay. Thank you.
We have time for one more question. Well, we are at 4:01, so I would like to thank our speakers. Thank you so much for sharing your wealth of information with all of us today. Really appreciate it. I learned a lot. I hope others did too. And thank you so much for joining us. This webinar is being recorded, and so you can access it online in the next few days. And if you have somebody in your office that might be interested, forward to them. We will also be sending up a follow-up email with all the resources as well as the slides available for your reference. And also want to remind folks about FRAC's National Anti-Hunger Policy Conference. Registration is now open. It will be held March 5th through 7th in Washington, D.C., and we hope to see you all there. The early bird rate expires January 13th, so register soon. And thank you again for joining us, and hope to have you on another Breakfast Matters webinar. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Preparing the list now.